Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Today, coming to you from the Houses of Parliament. As MPs return to Westminster after the summer recess, did the whole of my Times Radio show from down here in Westminster, hence the echo, in the beautiful Upper Waiting Hall, it's called, which the name doesn't really give credit to its grandeur. Lots of carved statues of kings all around us, gold-plated crests, an enormous fireplace, and above me, an enormous painting of King Lear. Make of that what you will. Coming up on today's episode, we take a look at some exclusive YouGov polling into what the public think of the Cabinet. Boris Johnson, Keir Starmer, Priti Patel, and yes, Dominic Raab after his holidays. Henry Zeffen will pick over that. We'll also speak to some MPs who were elected in 2019 and only had a few weeks in Parliament before the pandemic hit. What do they want to get out of the coming weeks? We're also going to bring you on a Monday our PM of the week. Andrew Jimson, the author, has been counting down all 55 Prime Ministers since the beginning of the year, and we thought, actually, they're so good, we'll start to bring you them on the podcast. So coming up today, we've got Asquith, but first it's our columnist panel. Today, Rachel Sylvester joining me in person, along with Lucy Fisher from The Telegraph. There's so much we could talk about this morning. Let's focus on social care, because it's the big issue of the week, it seems, Rachel. And Boris Johnson seems to have just... We spoke to Rob Halfon, one Tory MP, a couple of minutes ago. He says, I would vote for a national insurance rise to pay for social care, but only if it kicked in at £40,000. And I suspect we're going to get 300-odd different ideas from every Tory MP. I will vote for it, but only if you just do it like this and you tweak it like that. It's a big problem, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly. And the problem is they've decided on this national insurance rise, it seems, really based on politics rather than the policy. So they thought Tony Blair and Gordon Brown got away with this, put a penny on national insurance for the NHS, we'll do the same, nobody will notice. But actually, it's quite bad policy because pensioners, working pensioners, don't pay national insurance. Lots of things aren't covered by it, rental income, dividends, etc. So actually, a much fairer way would just be to do a basic rise on income tax across the board for everyone. So everyone's going to have something they don't like. The truth is, we do all have to contribute. It's not something that only pensioners should pay, because we're all going to need social care at some point, or we might all need it. So the key thing is you've got to spread the risk between as many people as possible. So it's sort of like a massive insurance scheme, and everyone pays the least possible amount. But Tory MPs don't want anyone to pay anything.
And the big issue, Lucy, is that we haven't really heard very much about what we're going to get for this extra tax.
Yes.
There's a big row about putting up the national insurance, but not really, you know, apart from Boris Johnson saying we are going to fix social care more than 2 years ago. What does that mean?
Well, I think it's a really good point to make about the sequencing of all this, that the row over the funding for the reform has come ahead of any any policy details being outlined. In a way, I think that's a mistake, because in actual fact, you have real consensus about the fact that social care reform is long overdue and that this is a nettle that needs to be grasped immediately. So I think that that was a sort of starting point of consensus that the government could have run from, set out the plans, gained a degree of support over that, done some pitch rolling, and then talked about the money side of it. So I find that a little bit bizarre. But certainly now, I slightly disagree with you, Rachel, that I think that all Tories disagree with there needs to be a tax rise for pay for this. I think there are some. Marcus Fish, chairman of the Economic Growth Group of Conservative MPs, people like him, very much on the right of the party, economically speaking, I do think you're right, are object in principle to any kind of tax rise and breaking the manifesto tax log. But I think there is a spectrum of opinion, and others are more open to it. But I think, as you said, Rachel, want to see it done in what they consider a fairer way, particularly when it comes to the generational element. This is going to be a policy that benefits older people. It shouldn't fall on the shoulders of the working age population, including those on low wages.
It's just a real sort of cart before the horse. Rather than deciding what do we want social care to look like, how much is that going to cost? And then how are we going to raise that, and what are we going to... It seems like they've had an argument about 1% and 2%, possibly landed on 1%, and then presumably going to solve that, that's going to raise that amount. How thinly can we spread that? Mm. And so we could end up in a situation where we don't fix social care after all.
Well, the irony as well is that the plan has been there really for more than 10 years. Andrew Dilnot published it, and it was even before he published his report, the sort of consensus was building around this idea of a cap on care costs. There's also pretty much a consensus now across the board about the need to improve wages and make sure there's enough care workers coming into the system to deal with the ageing population. So actually the system reform, there is quite wide agreement on what needs to happen. But the strange thing is Boris Johnson claimed he had a plan ready to go, 2 years ago, didn't then say what that plan was, and now has got into this row about funding.
Far be it for me to cast aspersions on the Prime Minister. I think it's fair to say that 2 years ago he did not have a plan prepared.
I think that's very fair to say, but Andrew Dilnot did.
Uncharacteristically, he may have said something that turned out not to be entirely the case. What about the politics of this, Lucy? Keir Starmer's given an interview to The Mirror. He's had a quiet summer, I think it's fair to say, and so he's tried to sort of come back, hitting the ground running, speaking to the Daily Mirror, the sort of the in-house paper of the Labour Party, but he's ruling out Labour backing an increase in national insurance. So again, we risk turning this into a sort of a massive political row, and therefore MPs in seats where Labour are close behind, those MPs might start wobbling. So instead of solving something that in theory everyone agrees on, we had it before when there were cross-party talks, and then it turned to the death tax, and it all fell apart. What do you make of the Labour's approach to this?
Well, I think first off, you're right, Matt. It has been incredibly quiet summer for Labour. The latest opinion poll shows they're still 5 points behind the Conservatives in the polls. Keir Starmer's come out and said that Labour won't support a national insurance rise to fund the long-term overhaul of social care. He hasn't set out an alternative, though. There's a lot of pressure on him from Andy Burnham, King of the North, to look instead to a wealth tax, taxing wealth instead of work. I think Labour really need to come forward and put their own stamp and policy proposals out. Keir Starmer said in this Mirror interview that he wants to wait until the next manifesto is drawn up, several years hence when this policy might even be implemented. And I think a key reason that's important is because it's not clear what the alternatives are. I think income tax is a serious alternative. It's one of the big levers, like national insurance, like VAT. Some of the talk in Labour circles about, for example, raising capital gains tax, it's not clear that would raise enough money. I think another area where we haven't heard Labour really speaking a lot about yet, but I think is going to become a big issue of contention in all this, is that this is a levy that's not just going to fund social care reform. It's also supposed to be the extra money that the NHS needs. We need to see exactly what the government's going to set out in terms of national insurance rises and how much it will raise. But a lot of the talk has been that it'll be about £10 billion a year. Well, that alone is what NHS leaders say that the health service needs.
So there's nothing left for social care.
So there's nothing left for social care. And I think that's why we've seen this really down-to-the-wire wrangling between the Prime Minister and the Chancellor over the weekend, because Rishi Sunak is desperate to make clear that if he agrees to a big tax rise now, that this isn't just going to be the thin end of the wedge and he's going to have to put it up, you know, next year or the year after to deal with all sorts of things like the NHS waiting list, extra costs for PPE, hospital cleaning and all the other fallout from the COVID pandemic.
Well, let's talk about Rishi Sunak for a bit, because he's got quite a lot of trying to get his spreadsheet to add up is going to be a big challenge over the coming weeks. I've mentioned this on the show before, but I remember speaking to someone at the Treasury who said, it was at a time when everyone said, Rishi's been taken hostage by Treasury orthodoxy. And they said, it's not Treasury orthodoxy, it's maths. And what you spend should, in theory, match what you're raising. You can't permanently go on borrowing. So alongside this row about social care and how he's going to raise the money for that, there's a big row coming, I think, on Wednesday. Labour are going to force a vote on the taking the £20 universal credit uplift away. That's due to kick in next month. Again, the politics of this is really tough, isn't it, Rachel? Because these are the families, low-income working families, who Boris Johnson made real inroads with.
Exactly. You've got Marcus Rashford now coming out against that universal tax credit card. I think there's a really interesting dynamic here politically. So there is obviously tension between the Treasury and Number 10 and between Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson. You only have to look at them to see the difference in temperament and attitude and politics. You know, Rishi Sunak, very controlled, disciplined, very thin. Boris Johnson, let it all hang out, spend. But I think there's for me, what's most interesting is there's also a sort of internal conflict within the Tory coalition. So those sort of traditional Shire Tories who want their taxes low, they're state controlled, and then the sort of new red wall Conservatives, who many of whom are probably on universal credit, depend on the public services. And that's a kind of really fundamental disagreement about the size of the state, how taxes should be raised, whether tax should be on wealth or work. And so in a way, that's an internal conflict within the Tory coalition and therefore within the Prime Minister himself, as well as between Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak.
This is what happens when cakeism comes up against reality,
exactly.
Isn't it, Lucy? The seeds, actually, of most of what we're going to see over the next few weeks were sown 2 years ago in the run-up to that election campaign. And if you have a manifesto which promises we will fix social care and we won't put up tax, that doesn't work.
No, that's right. And, you know, I think we just have to look at the whole list of spending demands that are beleaguering the Treasury. You know, the green agenda is another massive theme of this autumn in the run-up to the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow. You know, all sorts of spending needed there around infrastructure for electric vehicles to subsidise the switch from gas boilers to greener alternatives. Then you get to the education catch-up, which you know all about, Rachel, the backlog in courts, the £2 billion funding hole for the railways. And, of course, then there's levelling up. You know, the agenda the Prime Minister considers this legacy-defining dimension of his premiership, that really needs to be kind of filled in with all sorts of infrastructure investment. So,
And Afghanistan,
of course, and the cost for resettling, you know, thousands of Afghan refugees who are now arriving in the country. So it's hard to see, you know, how Rishi Sunak gets that maths to square up.
Well, we'll have to see if he does. What do you expect? Have you had a walk around Parliament this morning? How normal does it? I mean, it never feels that normal. It always feels a bit hogwarts-y. How normal does it feel, Rachel?
I haven't actually had a complete wander around, but the MPs are looking very smart, the ones I've seen.
Very good. What about you, Lucy?
Yeah, good. I had to wait, you know, a whole 3 minutes in the queue for a coffee this morning. PCH,
Portcullis
House.
Buzzing.
It's feeling busy. I'm desperately glad that everyone's coming back.
Lucy Fisher and Rachel Sylvester there. Right, next up, it's our Prime Minister of the Week. Yes, it's 300 years since Britain got its first Prime Minister. And every week this year, we are looking at one of them in detail with our resident historian and author, Andrew Jimson. I'm delighted that Andrew joins me live in the Houses of Parliament. Morning, Andrew.
Absolutely wonderful to be here. And just round the corner from a great corridor, the committee corridor, full of splendid portraits of prime ministers.
Now, although you have got a jacket and tie on, I should point out you are wearing chinos. So don't let the Commons Speaker.
That's a bit much.
Don't let the Commons Speaker see you doing that. You'll get into lots of trouble. Right, so who is this week's Prime Minister?
This week's Prime Minister is Asquith, who was Prime Minister from 1908 to 1916. Tremendous Olympian intellect, spotted by Gladstone as soon as he came into the House of Parliament. First ministerial office was the Home Office, and he was the inevitable successor when Campbell Bannerman died in 1908. Everyone, and he had to go off to Biarritz, actually, to see the King, George VII, who was in Biarritz. And then he started making his cabinet, and he had two figures who would emerge as really titanic figures of the 20th century. He had Lloyd George in his cabinet, and also Winston Churchill into the cabinet in 1908.
So he wasn't a prime minister afraid to have big beasts.
No, but he was above them as long as peace lasted. He was the Olympian figure. People said he was like a judge. He'd listen and then he'd decide. He'd guide the conversation. He wouldn't say very much himself. But he was. The First World War was such a horror that one somehow forgets that before the war, this country almost had a civil war over home rule for Ireland, which Asquith was putting through, and Ulster was going to fight, and things had got very desperate by the summer of 1914. Asquith was writing letters during cabinet meetings to a young woman who he was besotted with called Venetia Stanley. He wrote her 600 letters in 3 years, and he assured her towards the end of July 1914 that we weren't going to be involved in the war. luckily, we would just be spectators of this thing. And on the 4th of August, we were into the war. I mean, not predicting the fall of Kabul is not. I mean, these things.
History has
the Germans marched through Belgium, yes, violated Belgium.
History has a habit of repeating itself.
Exactly. Yes.
In that sense. And what sort of character was he?
Well, people said his critics said that he just drifted, and that he was too fond of drink. And
including
bridge.
Even at the dispatch box.
I'm afraid he was sometimes the worse for the drink at the dispatch box. He was never exposed at the time. Churchill wrote to his wife saying that it had terrible, in 1911, saying it's terrible. The Prime Minister could not speak last night. It was deeply embarrassing. But somehow there was what Churchill called a Freemasonry in the House of Commons in those days. And of course, no pictures of.
No recordings at all. So I suppose that's the thing is that yes. These days, we walked literally down the corridor, went into the Commons Chamber, there's microphones, there's cameras everywhere.
Yes.
Boris Johnson, for all of his faults, could not turn up in the House of Commons drunk and it not be spotted.
It would be spotted. And when Rees-Mogg sort of reclined on a bench, even that was thought by the prosy modern standards to be going a bit far.
Yes, although at least he wasn't wearing chinos. I was struck looking at Asquith's records that 1908 to 1916, actually compared to the way we were chopping through them, it's a decent chunk of 8 years.
Yes, it was a long
divided by the First World War.
Yes, and he was popular when the war broke out, but then as the war became more and more awful, people didn't want this sort of detached manner of leadership. And he had to form a coalition with the Conservatives in 1915 to defuse criticism. And then the Conservative leader, Bonar Law, was off to France for important meetings in France. And he had to see the Prime Minister first on a Monday morning. And the Prime Minister said, could you visit me at my country house on the Thames near Abingdon? And so Bonar Law, it was a blinding bore. He went to Abingdon. He was shown into the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister was playing bridge with three young women. And Bonar Law, Canadian Presbyterian by origin, didn't think that was funny. So there was a kind of frivolity about Asquith, as well as this ability to transact business. And eventually, I mean, somehow people realised that they needed Lloyd George to be running the war effort and not Asquith. Asquith wouldn't serve under Lloyd George. He went out, the Liberals split. Lloyd George was the last Liberal Prime Minister. So in fact, he came in as this dominant figure and left the party, although no one realised it was shattered irrevocably.
And is that because the war changed everything, that what people wanted from their politicians changed?
Yes, they needed a warrior, and there were, of course, there was a tremendous shortage of shells, and Lloyd George dealt with that, and then, somehow they knew. And the people around Asquith, I think, knew as well. I mean, but it was a tragic thing. I mean, as for so many people, his brilliant eldest son, Raymond Asquith, was killed on the Western Front. So it was a very hard thing for him. But he had this curious insistence on relaxing. So he'd just go over to the Athenaeum and read a novel for a couple of hours or something. But particularly bridge and drink and holding young women's hands.
Yeah, well, you couldn't imagine these days, our Prime Minister spending the afternoon playing cards with three young women.
No.
It was impossible exactly. To imagine. And how are you finding, as you're here, because you're sort of based here in Parliament, how have you been, wandering around? Are there a lot of people around Parliament? How was your office?
My office, my chair had been nicked. And there are lots of, but there was no one else in the room, so I couldn't launch an investigation into.
But presumably you could just nick somebody else's chair.
Yes, I borrowed someone else's chair. Yes, but it's all a bit quiet. But it is really important to get Parliament back, I think, and to have the chamber full. As for the Afghan debate, I mean that is much than even if the opposition is coming mainly from within the Conservative Party, which. They're the people who have the power.
It often does, but also it's a big test. It was a big test of Keir Starmer, but also a big test of Boris Johnson, who hasn't really had to face the cut and thrust of the Commons Chamber.
No,
given that he won that landslide election victory, everyone was very happy with him. We were quite quickly into COVID, then lockdowns, and we haven't had that. He hasn't been truly tested at the dispatch box yet, or in the voting lobbies.
He hasn't. He wasn't good in Parliament as a backbencher because he wouldn't devote enough time to it. He's been better at the dispatch box, I think, but he will be properly tested, and you'll be able to see whether his own troops are behind him or not.
Yeah, it's a bit. That's true. And if people start shaking their heads, as they tend to,
just go quiet. And
Theresa May does one of her death stares. You know he's in trouble, mate. Shooting lasers across the Commons Chamber. Andrew Jimson, then, you can pick up a copy of his book, Jimson's Prime Ministers, From Walpole to May, wherever you get your books from. Up next, what do voters really think of the Cabinet?
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, let's dig into some exclusive polling with Henry Zeffen. Now, Henry, in a moment, we're going to speak to some of the new intake of MPs about, they're not that new now, but they haven't had very many weeks here. But with you, thought we'd look at the Cabinet, because amongst all the other things that Tory MPs are talking about in their various WhatsApp groups, it's just whispers of a reshuffle. How likely is that, do you think?
It's quite hard to tell. Lots of people do think it's very serious, and there's been enough
days of rumour that there's going to be a reshuffle, that Downing Street has had enough of an opportunity to scotch the rumours if it's definitely not happening. On the other hand, it's quite a useful thing for them to have out there, because there are big things coming this week, controversial things coming this week, as you've been discussing in the hour of this show so far. And, you know, nothing will make a cabinet minister suppress their concerns about what Boris Johnson is planning to do with social care, like the threat of demotion or the prospect of promotion. So, you know, it may be real, but whether it's real or not is very useful for Downing Street to have it out there hanging over ministers.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of them then. So we've got some exclusive polling from YouGov where they have asked people, instead of how they would vote, because actually I think in the latest YouGov poll, the Tories have a sort of 4 or 5 point lead, but in terms of what they think of the politicians themselves. Let's start with Boris Johnson, first of all. Do voters have a favourable or unfavourable view of Boris Johnson?
Overall, they have an unfavourable view. So 36% of respondents to this survey said they had a favourable opinion of Boris Johnson. 55% said they had an unfavourable opinion. So that's a negative, net negative of 19 points. So that sounds quite bad, right? This is Boris Johnson. He's the Prime Minister. He won a landslide 2 years ago. Surely his opinion rating should be higher than that. Well, yes and no. If you look at the cross breaks of the polling, so if you look at the what 2019 Tory voters think of Boris Johnson, the people who gave him this huge majority, the picture's quite a bit rosier for him. He's got a net positive rating of 41 points. So it doesn't matter that people who voted Labour and Lib Dem in 2019 still hate him. They hated him in 2019.
That's why they didn't vote for him.
He won a huge majority. And so, you know, while there is perhaps a little bit to be concerned of in, 28% of 2019 Tory voters having an unfavourable opinion of him, I think we all knew in 2019 that there were plenty of sort of Tories holding their nose and voting for Boris Johnson for whatever reason, perhaps because they were Remainers, but, you know, didn't want Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister or something like that.
It's amazing that old Leave Remain cross break is still there. 20% of Remainers are favourable towards Boris Johnson, 58% of Leavers.
Yeah, although actually even that percentage of Remainers, I think, is not bad for him.
One in five.
If you scroll down and look
at
Michael Gove, I mean, basically every person who voted Remain in 2016 despises Michael Gove, although so do many Conservatives, Labour and Lib Dem voters. So it's not necessarily a view of Michael Gove confined to that column on the spreadsheet.
Well, let's pick through some of those. Just on Boris Johnson, one thing that really leapt out to me is almost no gender split. At various times, there were sort of think pieces written about how Boris Johnson has a woman problem. And actually, in terms of favourable and unfavourable, it's almost exactly the same men and women.
I mean, the main thing that leapt out to me about this spreadsheet about Boris Johnson, whichever crossbreak you want to look at, is that he's very popular. And it does feel sometimes, particularly in this place, although not necessarily if you go out to various parts of the country that voted for him, you do have to remind both people you speak to and yourself that Boris Johnson is the preeminent electoral politician of our age, if our age comes after Tony Blair. Boris Johnson, it should not be a surprise at this point. He won a huge majority in 2019. I'm pretty sure that we would not have left the European Union if he hadn't endorsed and campaigned for Vote Leave. He won two London mayoral elections in a city which had previously not just voted Labour but voted independent for Ken Livingstone. The man is very good at politics. It should not be a surprise to us that people like him. But, you know, in all this discussion of, you know, the missteps that he's undoubtedly
made. It's a good counterpoint to Twitter. And I have, talking about Twitter, I have just tweeted the chart that we're talking about, so you can see who's up and who's down amongst senior politicians. The only person polling better than Boris Johnson is Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor. He's actually got a positive rating.
Yes, and positive, net positive of 8. That is quite rare. I think he's the only person who was polled here who does have a positive rating. 44% of people say they have a favourable opinion, 36 say they have a negative. Among 2019 Conservative voters, his ratings are even higher than Boris Johnson, plus 51 to Johnson's plus 41. Among 2019 Labour voters, he's much less unpopular. Boris Johnson has net negative of 81 amongst 2019 Labour voters. Rishi Sunak just a net negative of 29. So again, not very surprising. We know that Rishi Sunak became very popular, particularly around the time of the furlough scheme being announced, but also because he was the sort of first minister to appear in one of those early daily press conferences to show a bit of common empathy and actually speak vaguely humanly about you know, the disaster which was engulfing so many people's lives. But, you know, if you want to feed this into a question of, okay, well, why don't Conservative MPs just dump Rishi Sunak for, or dump Boris Johnson for Rishi Sunak? You know, Rishi Sunak seems even more popular. Well, you know, I do think if you speak to Conservative MPs, you know, the man is still just a year and a half into being Chancellor. He has so far only had to make fairly popular decisions, albeit in a very crisis-dominated time. And I think the next week, the questions over social care and the tax to pay for it and the months that follow will give us a much better sense of Rishi Sunak's mettle in terms of the internal debate in government, policy debates and political questions, but also in terms of whether the public is going to continue to see him as a sort of better version of Boris Johnson.
I suppose the interest, I mean, instead of seeing everything through the prism of rivalry between the two men, there is a issue of sort of yin and yang, that they do complement each other. If Rishi Sunak is reaching into Labour, people who voted Labour in 2019, and he's winning them over and charming them, while Boris Johnson's holding on to people who voted Conservative in 2019, that's a pretty formidable political machine.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you don't see... There's no reason we have to see... I mean, look, clearly they are disagreeing on some things at the moment, but ultimately it's good for the Prime Minister if his Chancellor is popular.
Yeah.
Certainly better for the Prime Minister than his Chancellor being dramatically unpopular.
Or completely unknown, because then he has to do all the heavy lifting himself. Talking of unknown, let's turn our attention to some of the other Cabinet Ministers. Dominic Raab dominated over the summer. Actually, I'll be honest, having looked at the chart... Dominic Raab is now down to, was it minus
39.
Minus 39.
Doesn't sound great.
Which is pretty bad. But he was already in a pretty bad... He wasn't hugely popular before. I was surprised it wasn't a bit worse.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder whether some of the sort of stuff to do with Dominic Raab's holiday is one of those sort of slightly Westminster versions, you know, where Westminster focuses on a particular element of a story, whereas I think what a lot of voters will be paying attention to more so you know, is what the disaster that's unfolded in Afghanistan, or the, you know, the questions about Britain's long military involvement there and whether it was worth it. But I still don't think it's good. I mean, you know, the man is deeply unpopular, including with Conservative voters, where he has a net negative of 8 points. And so in the context of the reshuffle, I mean, you know, the big reshuffles are ones where a senior minister gets moved.
Well, that's the point. There's no point, as perhaps you could argue Keir Starmer discovered, there's no point embarking on a reshuffle unless you're going to make big changes that people are going to notice. And particularly if you're in government, that means changing one of the big jobs. He's clearly not going to move Rishi Sunak. The other two jobs are foreign and home.
Sure.
And Dominic Raab is arguably, based on the headlines, you'd say he's put himself in the prime spot to be moved. But Priti Patel actually polls even worse.
Yes, Priti Patel has a negative rating of 47 points. And she's even more unpopular with Conservative voters than Dominic Raab. I mean, that's quite an interesting thing. I mean, Priti Patel is often talked about as this activist's favourite, Conservative activist's favourite. And this is a reminder that you know, Conservative voters are obviously a much larger number than the... incredibly paltry membership of the Conservative Party, famously paltry.
Also, I do wonder, it's one of those like accepted wisdoms that, oh, she polls very well. That people were saying that 2-3 years ago. Quite
yes,
a lot has happened
yes.
in that time.
And there might be various reasons why she's generally unpopular with voters. But no, I mean, well, you mentioned Boris Johnson's woman problem. Maybe, you know, he might be equivalently popular or unpopular with men as with women polling-wise, but there is a problem with the number of women in the cabinet, which is lower now, I think, than it was, you know, in 2006, Tony Blair's last cabinet. So, you know, I don't think it would be a great look necessarily to move a woman from a great office of state unless he was, you know...
Go to replace them with one.
Exactly.
The other, just finally, Henry, on this polling, the other thing that leapt out to me was poor old Ben Wallace, who has put in a shift over the summer. People like you and I may have said he'd had a better war, if you like, you know, he in terms of his sort of empathetic reaction to what was going on in Afghanistan, more so than Dominic Raab. But basically nobody knows who he is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could look at it and say as a net negative of 8 points. The reality is that only 28% of people had a view.
So 2% of people don't
But
know
look,
who he
if
is.
You're in Boris Johnson's cabinet and people don't viscerally loathe you, that seems to be success. So I suspect Ben Wallace, unless you're Rishi Sunak. So I think Ben Wallace will be staying where he is. I'm sure that's the case.
That's possibly right. Henry Zephyr, thanks so much for talking us through what the public think of the Cabinet, which I'm sure as and when Boris Johnson embarks on a reshuffle, whether it's this week or not, he'll be looking at exactly the sort of polling we've just been looking through. And like I said, if you want to see the chart that we've just been discussing, I've tweeted it at Matt Chorley. Now, in a moment, we're going to hear from three 2019 MPs who were elected 2 years ago, only had a few weeks in the Houses of Parliament, and then were immediately dispatched their constituencies for the first of several lockdowns. We'll speak to them in just a moment. But first, let's hear from an SNP MP. The trouble with MPs from Scotland is they're always travelling on a Monday morning. So before he set off, I spoke to Stephen Flynn. He was elected the SNP MP for Aberdeen South in 2019. And I asked him just how many times he'd actually set foot in the Houses of Parliament since the election.
Yeah, I've probably set foot a little more than some of my colleagues have, I think. I grew quite weary quite quickly of the virtual proceedings, and it's not too difficult to get from Aberdeen to London with a direct flight. So I went down quite a few times once we were able to travel and restrictions were lifted. But it's in no way been what I necessarily expected it to be, that's for certain. It's been an interesting 18 months, 2 years. In terms of trying to travel in and amongst all the restrictions, but I've felt safe. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it.
And what do you expect to be sort of you to be focusing on in the new term?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important question. COVID recovery is going to be the fundamental point. Obviously, we've got the Chancellor's autumn statement coming up, and we need to see what he's going to be doing. From my own niche perspective, I want to see lots of money thrown at the energy transition, and I want Aberdeen, the northeast of Scotland, to be at the forefront of that. We've obviously aware of the fact he's intending on cutting universal credit, so hoping he'll reverse his stance on that. But moving forward, as a Scottish nationalist, I want to see a situation where that COVID recovery is one that's under the control of the Scottish government. So I'm looking for a second independence referendum to be agreed to in the not too distant future. And hopefully we can get campaigning for me to be travelling to Westminster even less.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. It's a slightly weird situation you've got, that you've got a job where you are one of those turkeys who want to vote for Christmas. You want to be put out of your job. You want to be not going to Westminster. You almost don't want Westminster to work particularly well. It's sort of, a dysfunction of Westminster which treats Scotland quite badly. It's quite good for you mounting your arguments. It's a sort of weird tension of doing your job properly, helping your constituents and all that, while also proving that Westminster isn't serving Scotland. Do you have to sort of, are you a bit sort of schizophrenic like that?
I know what you mean. Yeah, I'm quite happy to be the last ever MP for Aberdeen South if that's what it means in terms of getting Scottish independence. Absolutely. Yeah, it's bizarre. You know, we get treated with contempt in that place. You see it every time Ian, our leader, obviously stands to his feet, and the Tories either heckle or leave. They've got no interest in talking about Scotland's future. But we're there to do a job, which is to talk about Scotland, to talk about what Scotland can achieve, and how we can put forward that alternate vision. And we have the platform to do that. And it's important that we engage on that basis. And that's what we're there to do. And that's what I've tried to do every day that I've been down there. And obviously, moving forward, I'll continue to do that.
Just finally, the big question is, when there's going to be a second independence referendum, when do you think it will be? When do you want it? Next year, year after?
I think the Scottish government, with obviously the new agreement with us and the Greens, have been quite clear that hopefully it will be in the first half of the new Scottish parliamentary term, which obviously just started not long after the May election. So that's our aim and our ambition. But we need to obviously be cognizant of the situation in relation to COVID. And I think anyone who tries to pin a date on anything at this moment in time is perhaps doing something that they have no control over. So yeah, my aim is certainly the next 18 months, 2 years, as I think all Scottish nationalists would hope. I hope we get to that point. And as I said earlier, we no longer have to be travelling to Westminster. And stuff will stop.
And what's the one thing about the Houses of Parliament you'd miss if you were no longer the MP for Aberdeen South?
That I'd miss? Oof, that's a tough question. You know what? I actually quite like the back and forward in the chamber. I came from a very robust local authority, and the House of Commons is just almost like a bigger version of that. So I quite like the to and fro, but I don't think it does anyone any favours, to be honest, the back and forth with politicians. But I personally quite like it, although I probably shouldn't say that.
It's quite fun for those involved. It's less fun for those watching, I think. Probably
I think that probably sums it up.
That was Stephen Flynn there, the SNP MP for Aberdeen South. First elected in 2019. I spoke to him before he headed off, leaving Aberdeen to head down to London. Well, now I'm joined here live in the House of Parliament by the Labour MP for Sheffield Hallam, Olivia Blake. Hi, Olivia. Nice to have you with us. We've also got on the line Alex Stafford, Conservative MP for Rother Valley, who's heading down to London. Hi, Alex.
Hi there.
Nice to have you with us. So, Olivia, here we are in the slightly ridiculously named upper waiting hall, which makes it sound like a small cupboard. It's not this very grand room in the House of Parliament. How many times have you been down here? Have you managed to not get lost? Do you know your way around enough as a new MP to not get lost?
You know what? It's been quite difficult because we had like 12 weeks and then lockdown, but I have been down quite a bit. But yeah, like committees haven't been sitting in these rooms. So I was on the Public Accounts Committee and yeah, I've never been in any of these rooms really. So yeah, not much at all.
What about you, Alex? How many times have you managed to make it to Parliament?
Well, I've tried to be down as much as possible. And really, since the end of the lockdown in March or April this year, I've been down every day in Parliament. So I believe parliamentarians should be in Parliament and should be doing the job we were elected to do.
And what is it about, what difference does it make about being in the chamber, Alex, against being on Zoom to ask your minister the question?
It makes a huge difference in the ways of doing things. But the most important difference for me is the whole purpose of debates. Debates are not meant to be prepared, read out speeches. And on Zoom, you constantly get MPs from all sides of the House. This is not pointing blame at any party, just reading out prepared speeches. And that's it, just the clips on social media. You can't actually have a proper discussion. You can't intervene. You can't challenge a point. And we've seen that actually lacks sort of any sort of dynamism and any sort of challenge the executive. So I think actually having that ability to interject and actually hold ministers, hold speakers to account is vital. Otherwise, frankly, you might as well just send a copy of your speech to Hansard and not bother reading it out.
Just fax it over. Yeah, just facts. What about you, Olivia? What do you think is important about everyone being here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does make a good difference. I think it has been good to be able to keep Parliament going and everyone who might not be able to attend Parliament to be involved during this period. But yeah, I think it's obviously nice to be able to intervene on speeches and kind of be in the chamber and hear the debate much more kind of lively. And we saw that on the day that we came back. So yeah, it is definitely a lot more.
And what about getting to know your colleagues in the Labour Party? Although, didn't make huge progress in overall numerical terms in 2019, there were quite a lot of new faces. Are you a gang in the sort of Labour 29 intake?
Yeah, we call it.
But is it all done via WhatsApp?
It's absolutely done via WhatsApp. So it's been really nice to get to know like the 2019 intake, as we call ourselves. But it's been really nice and kind of, I think we've all kind of been through the same experience and it's really kind of bonded us together in a way I don't know other intakes have been.
And if you've got plans for a night out, all of you together?
Oh, I hope so. That'd be nice. But yeah, I'm sure we'll get dinner and something very soon.
And what about you, Alex? Because obviously a whole load of new Tory MPs in 2019 scattered across the country and actually in parts of the country where the Tories haven't been before. How many different WhatsApp groups are you in for 2019ers, Red Ballers, Young Ones?
Literally over 30 different WhatsApp groups.
You
know, from a mixture of different policy issues, different wings of the party to different intakes, so even whether you've got children or not, whether the children go to the parliamentary nursery. I mean, there's so many different ones. It's
which group's the most annoying? Which one is people always posting in?
Oh, it's always the ones about sort of the backbench ones, sort of that good backbenchers having a good sort of complain here and there about everything and anything under the sun. So that's always a good fun one to watch. But we all know they all end up in the newspaper anyway. So
they do, exactly right. Exactly right. Well, obviously, one of the things that they're complaining about most, it seems, at the moment right now, Alex, is the idea of putting up national insurance to pay for social care. Where are you on this issue? Would you support that if that's what they bring forward, a 1% rise in national insurance to fund social care?
Well, let's be honest, I'm a Conservative, and therefore Conservatives, we shouldn't be raising taxes willy-nilly. That's the last thing we want to be doing. But what we want to do is actually see a plan. We can't just raise tax without a plan to actually make fundamental changes and make things better. My concern is if they just add an extra 1% off national insurance or whatever, but no actual fundamental ways to make social care and have social care provision better, it's a bit pointless. What we need is a new plan of how we provide social care and then see, OK, how much does it cost and how much we're going to need to get from the public and work it out that way. We can't just raise it without having a new way of providing social care and thinking about social care.
Alex Tufford there. And Olivia, I want to ask you about the Labour Party. Given everything that's happened over the summer, whether it's exams, Afghanistan, rows over social care, right across the board, you know, the record number of migrants crossing the channel on almost every policy area, the government seems to be in trouble. And yet they're still out polling the Labour Party. And in the polling we're just discussing with Henry Zeffman, Keir Starmer's polling worse. He's on minus 23, Boris Johnson's on minus 19. Are you worried that the public have made up their mind about Keir Starmer already and he's not having an impact?
Well, I think this year has been incredibly difficult to become leader of any party. And I think, you know, not being in the chamber as much, not having the opportunity to, like, have a proper conference last year has really made it quite difficult. So I'm really looking forward to Labour Party conference and seeing the leader set out his plans and where we're going to go. And I think that that will be a turning point. And I think more people will get to know the real Keir Starmer and see what our policies will take us.
Obviously, one of the advantages of being back in Westminster is that I can collar you in the coffee shop queue, but you can also collar Keir Starmer maybe in the voting lobbies or whatever. Ahead of that party conference, what's your one bit of advice for him? What would you like to see him do?
Oh, I just think, you know, looking forward, we need to be really ambitious. And, you know, I'm Shadow Minister for Nature, so I'd obviously love to see something around COP15 and COP26 and what Labour's plans are for the environment, really.
That's a good area to focus on. Alex, if you manage to collar the Prime Minister in the voting lobbies, what's top of your list of things to bend his ear about?
Oh, the one I always bend here is the Levelling Up Fund. We put an application for £20 million, for £10 million for one of my high streets. We want that money, and I want to make sure the Prime Minister makes sure he delivers on the cash he's promised to our areas. So that's number one issue, and I'll be banging that drum constantly until the day I stop being an MP.
Very good. I suppose there was a slight tension there, Alex, is you want the money from him, but you don't want him to put up any taxes to find it.
Well, we can get the money from cancelling HS2 for a start. That would be the best thing forward for everyone, frankly. So the money's there, just cancel HS2.
The problem is his ear is going to be well and truly bent, I think, but even by the end of the day, but by the end of the week. Alex Stafford, thanks so much for joining us. Conservative MP for Rother Valley, heading down to Westminster and joining me live in the House of Parliament here. Olivia Blake, Labour MP for Sheffield Hallam. Good to see you. Thanks so much for joining us. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.